Venture capital isn't a household word in our part of the country, but our next guest thinks we in the Midwest should become better acquainted with the concept of venture capital so we can create better paying jobs. John Austin is director of the Michigan Economic Center and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Chicago Council of Global Affairs. He spoke at a Rotary Club event in Milwaukee last week, making the case that Midwestern states, including Wisconsin, are missing out on the explosive economic potential of venture capital. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be with you.
Now, as we get started, can you explain the term venture capital for us? It's a household word for some people. For a lot of us, not such a common phrase.
Well, venture capital are kind of the big investment bets that folks make when they're trying to create startups and blow them up to be fast-growing businesses. So the investment game in venture capital is very risky. It's not like, you know, treasury bonds or some of the equities where if you spread it around, you're going to guarantee good returns. The way venture capital works is you get some tens or 20 millions of dollars and you get maybe 200 or 500 of those millions and you invest, say, in 10 startups that might be emerging, new technologies, you know, new products that somebody at University of Wisconsin or some entrepreneur cooked up. And 9 out of 10 of those investments of, you know, $1 or $5 or $10 million will not pan out, will fail as a business. But the one that does may become, you know, the next Amazon or Duo Security. We just had a cybersecurity firm that spilled out of University of Michigan out here that had a $1 billion, IPO, a public offering of its stock after starting from nothing. So that's the kind of explosive growth that venture capital can contribute. And, you know, most of the firms that are kind of ruling the world's economy today got going from venture capital backing. And if anything, it's interesting. While only 0.1% of all the investments people and institutional investors and rich people make, you know, in stocks and bonds or hedge funds or venture capital, only 0.1% goes into venture capital, but it ends up being like 20% of the employment and value of companies that have grown from that initial sort of explosive startup base.
Yeah, spell that out a little more for those of us who aren't investors ourselves or working directly for a startup. What's in it for us if there's more venture capital where we are?
Well, I think since venture capital-backed firms, you know, are really the accelerants and kind of the explosive new job and business creators in emerging sectors that are developing new technologies. And so what venture capital backed firms that become big startups can do is really both, you know, create the kind of new businesses and jobs at scale that can begin to really put new people to work in new emerging sectors like, you know, new healthcare products, new IT communications devices for healthcare, new clean energy solutions, new things like, you know, Twitter communications or Airbnb or Uber that end up kind of changing the game in areas of transportation or in communication. And so they also then can really tell a new story about what the work of a region is. And that's a new story that we in Wisconsin and we in Michigan are very eager to tell and make real. You know, we created and ruled the industrial and agricultural economy where, you know, we created all these industries, including, you know, the machine tool industry centered in Milwaukee and the, you know, giant food processing industries and the car industry and all these, you know, industries that ruled the 20th century and employed lots of people and created lots of wealth. But all of those have been sort of diminished in certainly employment and in the kind of nature of what they contribute to the economy. But the fast growing, those giant global markets and fast growth and clean energy, new transportation solutions, clean water technologies like Milwaukee is leading in, IT is laced in everything. And healthcare, you know, Rochester, Minnesota nearby and University of Wisconsin are huge engines of new healthcare treatments, technology, ideas, services those are where the growth is. And when venture capital-backed firms explode in those emerging sectors, it tells a different story that we're doing the work of tomorrow. You know, young people in particular, they want to work in solving the big problems of today, like climate change or global health issues. And when you're doing that work and you're creating that kind of business and industry in Wisconsin or in Michigan, it tells a whole new story about us. We have the opportunity, and we do have the innovation horsepower in our region to create the work and the jobs and the businesses of tomorrow that pay well, just as we did the great jobs and industries that ruled the 20th century and made us so great.
Well, you use the word engine there. We have the engine in terms of the research into these cutting-edge technologies. But from what you've written about and the numbers you shared with us, we don't have a car to put that engine in because we don't have the venture capital that a lot of other places do.
Right. And so we're in this new report, the Vital Midwest, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs we published recently. It points out this irony or this contradiction. Here we have, particularly with the Big Ten universities plus Chicago in the region, we have 22 of the top 200 global research universities that are large scale, that win and produce more R&D, more intellectual property, more talent that we generate at scale in all domains, in science, technology, engineering, MBAs. So we're an amazing innovation engine and talent generator, which those two are the coin of the realm in today's growing tech-driven knowledge economy. But meanwhile, a quarter to a third of the nation's talent in across disciplines and new ideas and new technologies are coming out of the Midwest Great Lakes universities and companies. But we don't commercialize that. That usually turns into new businesses and jobs. Only 4% of the nation's venture capital is spent finding these innovations and backing them to the kind of explosive growth in the Great Lakes states around our vicinity. So we're trying to solve this problem, massive innovation that doesn't attract or the capital is not finding it to create this kind of explosive growth dynamic. We're also trying to treat another issue. We created great wealth in this region. Our companies, we invented the public pension fund, and we have foundations that are large. We have university endowments that are huge. All of those entities invest in a diversified portfolio, including venture capital. So we have massive wealth that is actually subsidizing the coast. Our institutional investors don't find their way to invest in Midwest and Milwaukee and Wisconsin venture capital firms, which could help them find the new innovation spilling out of our companies and our entrepreneurs and our universities. So here's the horrible truth. When half of the nation's pension funds, for example, money that is invested in venture capital is coming from our region, the Midwest, you know, only 10 or less percent of that comes back to invest in us. So we have massive innovation that isn't starting new businesses locally like it should. And we have, if anything, we're subsidizing coastal new tech startups.
Talking to John Austin, director of the Michigan Economic Center and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Chicago Council of Global Affairs. Looking at a mismatch, he and his colleagues say we've got a lot of great research and innovation going on in the Midwest, but not enough venture capital spent in the area to turn those ideas into the local economy and local jobs. John, what do we do about that? How do we get more venture capital, VC they call it, in the Midwest?
Well, we're encouraging and happy to see in Wisconsin, for example, the administration is now exploring with the venture and investor community and institutional investors how to do what some of the other states in the region have done successfully, like Indiana, like Michigan a while ago, like Ohio, which is create a state-backed innovation fund that puts some resources together from investments, say, that the state makes in the state pension system or the treasury investments that are invested each year, put some hundreds of millions of dollars together that is a vehicle that can then co-invest or invest in Wisconsin firms and venture capital entities, grow the size of those venture capital entities in Wisconsin so that they can attract credible investments from other institutional investors and coastal money and help the coastal money that's now, you know, looking for how to make a good investment and make some money by backing startups in the Midwest and in Wisconsin. If you've got a bigger venture capital entities, more critical mass of people and money in Wisconsin, so you're going to find and help outside people find a good investment to make in Wisconsin. Other states have done this with some success. It grew the size and scale of our venture activity in Michigan considerably and allowed then some of our venture firms to be the kind of place that institutional investors, pension funds, philanthropic entities can put their money responsibly. And so that's one way, and we're happy to see both at the state level and perhaps in communities like Wisconsin, Milwaukee, where I was just speaking, looking at what can be done locally too. We've seen examples of the private sector just stepping up in a place like Detroit, creating a fund of funds that is investing around the region but also investing and attracting more dollars to invest in Detroit area funds. So there's lots that can be done. We certainly would love to see a Great Lakes-wide or Midwest fund that created that would, you know, help outside dollars from the coast as well as our own dollars be making a good, responsible investment in the Midwest and grow our firms and grow our new businesses and jobs that pay well in all the emerging sectors where we've got the, as I say, the innovation horsepower, the smarts, the new ideas bubbling up to create another round of leadership in the economy of tomorrow, just as we did the economy of yesterday.
John, in our last couple minutes, I want to ask about that regional cooperation idea, because I could see this shaking out. You know, Wisconsin fights Illinois for venture capital. Michigan fights Ohio, as they do, for venture capital. Do you see an appetite for getting together and working as a region to lure this kind of investment?
Working together on anything is sometimes is an unnatural act. I don't think that's necessarily the path. The private sector can step up, and there's some interest from some of the investment community to build a kind of a regional fund that would be investing smartly and allow institutional investors and money from our own region, which we've got a lot, as well as outside dollars from the coast, who now are increasingly interested in how can we participate and make some money and also accelerate economic good things for more people and places in Wisconsin and Michigan, because it also kind of has a social impact of helping folks whose communities may have cut adrift from yesterday's economy, you know, maybe find purchase in a different economy. We can see self-interested parties. There's plenty of work to do. There's plenty of innovation to back, but you've got to kind of grow the ecosystem, as the venture community calls it. You got to grow the number and the size of firms and other early stage capital investors so that they have more resources and then can attract more credible investments and put them to work and make money for people, job one, that has the byproduct of creating new businesses and good paying jobs in the work that's coming. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be the one seizing those jobs.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Austin, director of the Michigan Economic Center and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and Chicago Council of Global Affairs. We talked to him today about his views on why the Midwest is missing out on a lot of venture capital and what states can do to get it. We've got a link to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs report John mentioned up on Central Times page at WPR.org. It's called A Vital Midwest, The Path to a New Prosperity. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farid. Right now it's time for our weekly roundup of national politics. Democratic lawmakers are pushing for new disaster relief money for Puerto Rico. Some moderate Democrats in Congress are still searching for a candidate they want to back in the presidential primary. And yesterday, President Trump issued pardons in a handful of high-profile cases and commuted the prison sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Sarah Ferris is a congressional reporter for Politico. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with a story you've been following, Sarah, an aid package meant for Puerto Rico. Now, we have an older disaster, hurricane, but there are also 11 earthquakes there over the last couple of months. What is going on in Congress right now when it comes to aid for Puerto Rico?
That's right. So this is actually a storyline that I don't think a lot of people are following, which is this earthquake swarm in Puerto Rico. As you mentioned, a dozen or more earthquakes have hit the island. Some of them have been smaller. Some of them have been really major, and there's a lot of infrastructure that's down. Of course, the infrastructure was weakened by the trio of deadly hurricanes that hit several years ago. And there's been this back and forth between Democrats and President Donald Trump on aid for Puerto Rico, basically since he since he came into office. And we've seen this again with the earthquake funding. And Republicans on Capitol Hill don't really want to meddle in this issue. They're kind of letting it stick between Democrats and Trump on this. But there's $5 billion at stake that Democrats say is really necessary for the people of Puerto Rico to get the rebuilding efforts underway. There's schools that kids aren't able to go to right now because they're not actually safe. And there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt to make sure that it's up to standards. So there was a trip of Democrats led by House Majority Leader Cindy Hoyer that went over the weekend. And I think we're going to see this be an effort to try to amp up that pressure on Trump and on some of these Republicans in Congress in the next couple of weeks.
Now, there's, I think, two different bits of aid we're talking about. There was a package approved back in 2017, first of all. Has all of that made it to Puerto Rico at this point?
So it has not, and that's one of the major problems. So Democrats, for months, years at this point, have been arguing that the Trump administration is slow walking that disaster aid. President Trump has criticized Puerto Rico a lot, really singling out this island, which of course is a U.S. territory, and saying that there's corruption and saying that Puerto Rico has mismanaged the money. Well, we really haven't seen evidence of that in terms of the hurricane funding. There have been some complications. Political scandals, really, on the island in the last couple of weeks. We saw the governor actually step down. There was even recently there was a warehouse full of supplies that was discovered that these supplies were never doled out. So there have even Democrats will acknowledge that there's been some missteps, but the Trump administration has been very, very hard on Puerto Rico's government going back to 2017, and a lot of the money just hasn't gotten there, and they've been holding it up, saying that they want more reviewing of documents, they want more reviewing of where the aid's going to go. And that's just not something that happens when, for example, money goes to Florida or goes to Georgia for other hurricanes. They just don't have the same kind of scrutiny that Puerto Rico has faced in the last 3 years.
That's the 2017 aid. Are Democrats in the House looking for earthquake-related aid above and beyond that now?
Yes. So Democrats in the House passed a package of nearly $5 billion. And there are Democrats in the House who will tell you that maybe that is a little bit more than Puerto Rico needs. But basically what they're doing is trying to set the bar here. They're trying to start a negotiation with Republicans. This, of course, Democrats hold the House, and so they're able to pass the amount that they want. And they're hoping that Senate Republicans will come to the table with another kind of offer that they can send to the White House. But White House has threatened to veto this entire package. So the prospect is really not looking good for even more of these community development block grants. That's the vast majority of the funds would go to that specific program, which falls under the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So that money will not be able to get there unless the White House changes its position on this.
We'll keep watching that story. Also in the news, just yesterday, President Trump issued a number of pardons and commutations, including commuting the prison sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was convicted on multiple charges, including soliciting bribes for the appointment to an empty U.S. Senate seat. Here's Trump talking about that decision.
I did commute his sentence, so he'll be able to go back home with his family after serving 8 years in jail. That was a tremendously powerful, ridiculous sentence, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others.
Do we know why the president decided to step in here on the case of Rod Blagojevich?
Well, it's a really interesting case because, of course, he was a Democratic governor, but he was also a friend of President Trump's. He had been on the Celebrity Apprentice show, and he also has just aligned himself with some of Trump's views over the years. In a press conference today, Blagojevich described himself as basically being persecuted by, quote, the swamp of Springfield. I mean, that's language that could have came out of Trump's mouth himself. So you do see a lot of parallels in the way that he kind of tries to appeal to this, to the populism that Trump has successfully ran on. So I think, it's clear that they do have those personal relationships that would make sense for why the president would choose to pardon him. But what's been really interesting is that he hasn't really gotten a lot of applause from either party on this. Of course, this is a disgraced Democratic politician, and Democrats don't want to see him pardoned. There are not a lot of Democrats who are happy about this. And if you talk to Republicans on the Hill, they're not happy about this either. There was a group of Illinois Republicans, including Darren LaHood, John Shimkus, Adam Kinzinger, Rodney Davis. They released a statement jointly and described him as the, quote, the face of public corruption in Illinois. And so they're trying to make a stand here that they don't want to be associated with the crimes committed by this former governor. But of course they're trying to strike that line of not going against the president. But of course they did not agree with his decision here.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of bipartisan cooperation in American politics, but people have been referring back to Blagojevich when he was impeached for all of these scandals. In both chambers of their legislature, from both parties, he got exactly, I believe, one vote against impeaching him. Otherwise, it was unanimous. Both parties wanted him out. There doesn't seem to be a lot of love in Illinois politics for this decision.
Right, right. And in his press conference today, it made it sound like it was almost a political rally. I mean, it's just such a different tone than what you would expect for someone who was sent to jail for the types of crimes that he committed.
And this was just one of a handful of commutations and pardons. What do we know about the rest of the group of people that were part of these announcements yesterday?
So he really announced a lot at once, and they tend to do this by just if the more that you announce at once, there's kind of less scrutiny. I think it was 11 people overall, and this is really something that we have been expecting for Trump. He's been post impeachment. He's really been emboldened. So there were the San Francisco 49ers team owner. He had pled guilty in 1998. So another pretty public face. There was the junk bond king, Michael Milken. He had been serving for another white-collar crime. So there was a lot of people who were pretty well-known and had been in the public eye for crimes that apparently President Trump did not think warranted as much time. You know, none of these were types that we saw from former President Barack Obama when he would seek out people who had been targeted, who were unknown people, who had been perhaps sent to jail for drug-related crimes or under the three strikes provision. He made more of a political statement opposing some of the stricter criminal justice laws in the country, and that's just not what Trump did. He's not sending that kind of a statement with his decisions announced yesterday.
Talking to Sarah Ferris from Politico, looking at some of the big stories in national politics, turning to the presidential race, another Democratic presidential debate tonight, the Nevada caucus coming up. You recently reported on how moderate Democrats in Congress are feeling about the state of the race as Senator Bernie Sanders takes the lead in a lot of polls. What are we hearing from moderate Democrats in Congress?
So moderate Democrats, of course, are the main reason that the Democrats were able to regain the House in 2018. There was a lot of Democrats in Trump-won districts. Basically, their districts had chosen Trump in 2016, but they went for Democrats in 2018. There's about three dozen of them, and a lot of them are worried about a Bernie Sanders ticket. They think that either their voters will abandon them and choose a fully Republican ticket or not come out at all. And that's problematic, of course, because the House Democrats are relying on these more what they see as more moderate in a lot of ways. They're suburban, wealthier individuals, and that's just not the demographic that Bernie Sanders has been doing really well with. And so there is a worry that Bernie Sanders could potentially cost them their reelection, potentially jeopardize the House, although I think that's not quite as likely. The numbers are still very good for the House in terms of their fundraising numbers, and the Republican challengers have not been as strong as expected. But, Bernie Sanders, if he does lock up the nomination, I think we are going to see some of these moderates have to distance themselves from Sanders. And that's a really hard balance to strike when you're trying to tout Democratic achievements in Congress, but yet not associate yourself with another member of Congress. He's not a Democrat, but Bernie Sanders, is someone who has been working with Democrats on a lot of the issues that they would be talking about on the campaign. So it really does strike a different, you'd have to strike a really difficult balance.
Now, that said, you talked to and heard from a bunch of different members, Democratic members of Congress. Are they lining up behind one particular alternative?
So a lot of them don't quite want to come out. They say it's too early. But what I am noticing is that a lot of people are looking to Michael Bloomberg. And I think part of it is the massive amount of money that he spent to help Democrats get reelected and to help recapture the House in 2018. He spent an unprecedented sum of his own personal fortune to make sure Democrats could recapture the House. So there is a trust there. And there's a lot of Democrats who are willing to stick their neck out and put an endorsement out for him. I also think there's the reassurance that you have to fight fire with fire. If you're going to have a New York billionaire on the ticket on the Republican side, let's put a New York billionaire who's not afraid to trash talk right up there on the debate stage with him. They see the kind of aggression fiery passion that from Bloomberg that Trump has been doing. I mean, there's some other moderates who might not be as willing to go head to head, and they're looking at Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, even Joe Biden in some ways, and wondering if they have the energy, the drive, the stamina to really go against Trump in a powerful way. And Bloomberg has been touting in meetings with members of Congress, in his television ads, in his rallies that he's held so far. He's been touting his ability to go toe-to-toe with Trump. So I think that's what's winning over a lot of moderate Democrats. That said, he's got about he still has under 15 endorsements from House Democrats. So it's really overall not a huge number, but there is a lot of interest within the moderate wing of the caucus, even if they haven't come out to endorse him yet. And perhaps they will after they see him on the debate stage for the first time tonight.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us for a regular look at the week in Washington.